all of the sort of white nationalists, what used to be alt-right as well, have looked to Hungary and Poland as exemplars for what they want. Part of their project is rehabilitating nationalism, finding a way to kind of give it entry into mainstream conservative politics. Part of this whole push is the idea that they are going to reassert majority rights. But their solution to that is we need to basically establish a benevolent theocracy.
Welcome to episode 95 of the Refuse Fascism podcast. This podcast is brought to you by volunteers with Refuse Fascism. I'm Sam Goldman, one of those volunteers and host of this show. Refuse Fascism exposes, analyzes, and stands against the very real danger and threat of fascism coming to power in this country. My voice is a little rustier than usual because I was screaming my head off yesterday. Yesterday was the 49th anniversary of Roe, and on Friday, tens of thousands of anti-abortion fanatics, feeling triumphalist, expecting this will be the last year of Roe, the last year of abortion rights nationally, flooded the streets. Their hatred for abortion rights has always been driven by their desire to control women and refasten the chains of their oppression. Yet precisely at this most dangerous hour, there is widespread capitulation by the Democrats, and all too many pro-choice leaders. But the enslavement of women, a Christian fascist nightmare for all of society, is nothing to capitulate to compromise with, to downplay, or prepare for. This must be fought. That's why I braved the cold and joined with Lori Sokol of Women's E! News, Merle Hoffman of Choices, Women's Healthcare Clinic, Katia Stitz, Program Director for WPFWDC, Sansara Taylor, Strike for Choice, the New York City Rev Club, and activists from DC, Ohio, New York City, and as far as California, outside the Supreme Court yesterday, to announce to the world that a force is gathering, coming from many different political perspectives, united in our shared determination to wake up and mobilize thousands and soon millions to fill the streets with our fury. Our refusal to surrender, not just for one day, but coming back day after day in acts of defiance and outrage that wake up and rally even more people, shaking all of society and making clear to the Supreme Court and everyone else that we will not surrender or back down. Abortion on demand and without apology. We didn't get diverted when swarmed by young theocrats. Instead, we came back with, we won't back down. We won't submit. Your women hating shit. And there is a role and a need for every single one of you listening to join. We've got to rely on ourselves, which means everyone stepping in and stepping up, learning from each other and doing this together. And so I hope that everyone listening will join me next Sunday, January 30th, for a national Zoom organizing conference to prepare to go out together throughout society and reach and organize others starting now to mobilize for major nationwide marches and rallies on March 8th, International Women's Day, in big cities and small towns on the campuses. A link to the Zoom sign up is in the show notes. In today's episode, we're sharing an in-depth interview with author and investigative reporter Catherine Joyce on the power of ideology in the fascist movement, especially how and why Hungary is a model for the GOP. But first, this week in fascism. In case it wasn't clear that we face a serious fascist threat, this week served as a painful wake-up call as fascists advanced their program on key fronts, including but not limited to voting rights and the assault on abortion rights. It also illustrated, as W.B. Yeats put it, the best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. The truth we have to confront is that the Democrats can't lead us out of this mess. They couldn't even get their whole party to unite to get basic voting rights legislation passed. But to really understand any of it, in my opinion, this quote that I'm going to read gives absolutely necessary background in speaking to the deepening existential crisis racking the American empire. Revolutionary leader Bob Avakian explains, quote, The Republicans have certain significant advantages over the Democrats in this conflict. The Democrats are committed to playing by the rules and relying on the norms of democratic capitalist dictatorship, while the Republicans are moving to tear up those norms and rule through an open, undisguised capitalist dictatorship. The peculiar nature of this country, with its history of genocide, slavery, and continuing white supremacy, and repeated compromises that have given disproportionate power, power greater than what is represented by their populations, to southern states of the former Confederacy and other states with significant rural populations of conservative-leaning people. This is another advantage that the fascist Republicans have. If this battle remains on the terms of this system, not only will there be horrific consequences overall, but this could very likely lead to a triumph for the Republican fascists, which would accentuate and accelerate the looming disaster for humanity as a whole, end quote. So we saw voting rights smackdown in the Senate. And in case anyone was confused about what this was all about, Mitch McConnell made it crystal clear when he said the quiet part out loud, essentially saying that Black people aren't Americans. What is the response from the leader of the free world? Vote harder. And this logic runs deep into their base, where even as we tweet about breaking out of the confines of electoral politics, we get responses like, quote, without federal voting rights protections, you are wasting your time, end quote. It really is a kind of enslavement to the terms of this system and learned helplessness, that all our power is in the actions of our so-called representatives. And if they don't act, we have no power to act. This circular reasoning is deadly. On the abortion rights front, the Supreme Court made yet another decision, ensuring that SB 8 would remain intact, effectively banning abortion in Texas. This came down as tens of thousands of anti-abortion fanatics and brainwashed Catholic high school students were bused into Washington, D.C. and San Francisco for the annual March for Female Enslavement, aka March for Life. On the 49th anniversary of Roe, and what could very likely be the last anniversary, Biden and Press Secretary Psaki could not bring themselves to say the word abortion, but promised to use all the tools at their disposal to protect Roe v. Wade without specifying anything besides supporting congressional Democrats dead on arrival, quote unquote, Women's Health Protection Act. The idea that this is being promoted by anyone as a viable solution the same week that the voting rights bill got crushed, it is absolutely shameful. The quote unquote reproductive rights movement eerily parrots, in my opinion, March for Life talking points regarding the danger of a post-Roe future not being so bad. Whatever their intentions, leading people to prepare for a post-Roe future, to share information about the abortion pill, to help raise money for people to cross borders to get abortion, and telling us to not scare people by protesting and exposing the reality that abortion bans kill people, destroy lives, and cast a dark shadow over the position and role of women in society. Whatever their intentions, it amounts to capitulation in advance. And lastly, with ever more damning evidence, the January 6th Commission chugs along, with millions waiting with bated breath, hoping something substantial actually comes of any of this before the 22 elections, which, as things stand, will almost certainly end the investigation, reverse any findings, and if the fascist GOP lives up to its promises, lead to retaliation against the commissioners. Amidst all of this, Biden held a two-hour-long press conference, which many hailed as a victory, simply because he didn't berate the press, have a total meltdown, or walk out. But in it, he also actually said some things worth noting, including that he did not anticipate the Republicans' priority would be to stop him from accomplishing anything. This isn't a failure to anticipate. It's been a choice from before day one to view the fascist opposition as civil, willing to bargain, because that is the entire premise of the empire that Biden is trying so hard to maintain. He also said that he doesn't know, quote unquote, what they are for. It's obvious. Fascism. That is what the Republicans are for and what the Democrats continue to conciliate and accommodate to. There is no parallel track where people can be free in this society while fascists advance. We need to fight like hell, in mass, relentlessly, nonviolently, in the streets, refusing these assaults and the fascist program they are a part of. Now, here's my interview with Catherine Joyce.
I am excited to do this, particularly because of when we're doing this interview, the day before the March for So-Called Life and what could be the last anniversary of Roe v. Wade.
Just saw somebody point that out. I hadn't realized it was the 49th.
Yeah, it's really heavy. So I am so glad to have someone to talk to today about all this, especially someone so knowledgeable in our subject and dogged in her inquiry into the Christian right and its intersection with reactionary politics. I'm really happy to share with you a conversation that I'm going to have with Catherine Joyce. Catherine is an investigative reporter at Salon. She's the author of two books, The Child Catchers, Rescue Trafficking, and the New Gospel of Adoption, and Quiverful, Inside the Christian Patriarchy Movement. So welcome, Catherine. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Sam.
So I guess given that anniversary, I wanted to start with a question around abortion in some of the countries that you've been looking at as well. The Supreme Court right now is poised to gut or entirely overturn the legal right to abortion in this country. And if this happens, it would be a major turning point for the rights of women and the position of women in the society. In Poland and Hungary, the fascists have been able to go much further down this road for a place that has far greater gender equity only a few decades ago. I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit more about what happened in Poland and Hungary and what that experience might be able to tell us about where we're at right now in this country.
So I think there's a lot of history there. And I think, you know, we can only touch on a little bit of it here, but there has been a real conservative revolution in both of those countries, especially over the last decade, arguably for a lot longer. It's rolled back an awful lot of things. You know, in Hungary, as we're speaking right now, it's next week, I guess Tucker Carlson from Fox News is poised to go back to Hungary after having spent a full week there last summer, just celebrating this. Hungary and to some extent Poland, I mean, both of them, but Hungary has really kind of emerged as these conservative utopias for the US Christian right, but also just kind of all of the sort of white nationalists, what used to be alt-right as well, have looked to Hungary and Poland as exemplars for what they want. In Hungary, Viktor Orban, who proudly declares himself illiberal, you know, his government is fairly autocratic. He's tied a lot of things together from those two sides of the right, bringing religious right and sort of xenophobic right together, never always far apart, but really enmeshed them. He's advanced these pronatalist policies, which have been something that the Christian right in the US and around the world has been promoting for the last 20 years, but he has tied them. And some of these pronatalist policies are, well, we will help you buy a minivan. We will help you not pay income taxes if you have four children for the mother, which is a little bit of a moot point because probably not a lot of mothers who have four kids are going to be making a ton of income outside of the house. Orban has created all of these pronatalist policies ranging from subsidies to help people buy minivans if they have a certain number of children, to promising that women who have four children or more will be exempt from income taxes, which is a limited sort of offer that can be made to people. But he doesn't just do this to advance this long Christian right project of trying to encourage large families, which is something that groups like the World Congress of Families have been doing for about 20 years. But he's also tied it very explicitly to his anti-immigration and anti-refugee policies. He has said things to the effect that he thinks that Muslim refugees and immigrants are unassimilable, that multiculturalism is just an illusion, and has basically said, we don't want to import our babies, we will have our own, by which obviously he means Hungarian, in quotes, babies, which means white. There's been this sort of merging there of the sort of things that appeal to the Christian right, things that appeal to the sort of America first, Hungary first activists as well. And you can also see this in how a lot of rhetoric around the Christian culture of Europe, or increasingly they're using the same kind of language to talk about America, that needs to be restored. And in a lot of different ways, Christian culture here is not being used in a sort of holistic sense to describe anybody who believes in who is a Christian, but rather it's being used kind of with an emphasis on the cultural part. So basically, as a stand-in for cultural Christianity means people of kind of traditional European descent. So again, ultimately, this sort of boils down to white. So I think both of those things are things that are making Hungary stand out to the US as this sort of model that they could embrace. They're thinking about where do they go in the aftermath of Trumpism. Trumpism sort of blew up a lot of what kind of the conservative coalition used to be. A lot of them are looking to Hungary especially, but also other Eastern Central European countries as models.
What are the particular aspects that you think make Hungary in particular such an exemplar for what they're going for? Sure. Is it because he's been so successful? Is it because he's still able to maintain a certain amount of legitimacy?
A lot of it has to do with the fact that Hungary is sort of trolling the rest of Europe and the EU, the rest of the kind of regulatory structure there. It has been passing all of these laws, some of which put it, you know, directly at odds with various sort of human rights policies or standards or provisions that they, you know, are supposed to be agreeing to as members of the EU. You know, one example is that in pretty recently, Hungary passed this law that basically bans any LGBTQ content, and they would call it content that advocates LGBTQ lifestyles or kind of existence of LGBTQ people. They call it advocacy, but basically this applies to the existence of books that depict same-sex couples and families or that talk about LGBTQ kids. That is basically being banned from schools, from anywhere that minors would have direct access to it. But it's even going so far that bookstores in Hungary have had to put special labels on books saying, you know, this book depicts non-traditional content. So in that way, a lot of right-wing people who have been kind of going on these pilgrimages to Hungary over the last year, year and a half, people like Rod Dreher, who is a pretty prolific conservative author, and then also a number of pretty influential, maybe not the most recognizable names of right-wing intellectuals, people who are shaping at a pretty high sort of elite level what the right-wing ideology that they're hoping to kind of popularize and spread. Those people have been going on these fellowships, in particular to a couple of different colleges in Hungary and Poland. And as they go there on these sort of right-wing pilgrimages, they are coming and saying, you know, you wouldn't believe we have drag queen story hour in our schools, but here you are doing this really protective thing of your children by banning all of this content from reaching them in schools, by requiring these sorts of labels if they're going to find them out in a private business like a bookstore.
Learning about, I don't know if network is the right word, but I'm going to say it's a network. This, and I'm going to sound like conspiracy theorist because I'm like, international network. But there is an international network where the Christian right is learning from each other. And there's an exchange of, this is how we did it here. This is what you can do in your country. It's always something that has struck me that they really are giving each other blueprints and working together to figure out how to spread that dynamic. And I was wondering from your research, if there's any other thought that you wanted to share that you think that people need to be understanding about how these fascists from around the world are learning from each other.
I don't think it's a conspiracy theory to point out that people are organizing. Organizing isn't something that people only do on the left. The right, different sectors of it are very good at organizing at different levels. I perhaps should have started by giving a little bit more background of what I was talking about when it comes to Hungary. So I had a piece come out at the beginning of January in the New Republic looking at basically that sort of network. And a lot of my reporting was done in November when I went to this conference in Orlando of the National Conservatism Movement. So this is a movement that is very much trying to kind of reclaim, rehabilitate the term nationalism as a positive thing. And there are a lot of right-wing intellectuals who have released books in recent years arguing that nationalism is positive, all of the things that you associate with it that are bad, like Hitler, that was imperialism. Nationalism is scrappy little Poland fighting back against Hitler. So that's sort of part of their project, is rehabilitating nationalism, finding a way to kind of give it entry into mainstream conservative politics. Another big part of their project is they are trying to reshape a conservative alliance in what they feel is the aftermath of the realization that liberalism, small L liberalism, does not work. So they have kind of come to this perspective, led in large part by a number of Catholic right intellectuals who call themselves post-liberals, or some of them call themselves Catholic integralists, who think that small L liberalism that focused on individual rights, that this has basically led to a Western kind of status quo that offers people a lot of opportunities for individual decadence, but does not give them any sort of support to kind of live virtuous lives. It's an interesting and sort of complicated movement. They make some appeals on economic issues that can sound sort of appealing to left-wing audiences. They talk a lot about how corporations around the world are kind of behaving in imperialistic ways, but also in ways that really devalue the lives of individual workers. There is kind of this level of trying to make some strange bedfellows alliances there, but their solution to that is really, especially in the case of the Catholic integralists, is we need to basically establish a benevolent theocracy. We need to move beyond the idea of country that is governed with the idea of individual rights. And we need to realize that government is always either promoting virtue in their citizens or promoting vice. And so we need the government to enact all these laws that are going to shepherd people towards living virtuous lives. And that common good that they keep talking about is very much defined in religious right terms. So it's a virtuous life as defined by extremely conservative Catholics. And so that is sort of what they're going towards with the post-liberal project. There's been a lot of interesting writing about that. So those are sort of two prongs of that. But then where the international side of it comes in is sort of as this aspirational model. Catholic integralists have been sort of publishing a lot of stuff over the last 3 years or so, talking about how we're going to move beyond constitutional originalism. We're going to move towards common good sort of government. And the people who are writing about this have really kind of elaborate ideas of what they would like to see. They are all being kind of poo-pooed as this is never going to happen in America. Most Catholics would never want this to happen, let alone most of the rest of the country. So if you only have a small sliver of the 20% of Catholics who would want to implement this, this is really not a very realistic goal. And so instead, they are looking overseas to what they see as more reachable targets. And so that's where kind of Hungary and Poland come in. They're not Catholic integralist countries either, but these are countries that are kind of coming closer to their vision than probably anywhere else in at least Western society right now. So they're looking to them. They're looking to the ways that Viktor Orban talks up Christianity, even as Hungary is actually a very secular country. But Viktor Orban keeps making all of these pronouncements that he is doing things in defense of Hungary's historic Christian nature. So they're looking at that as, okay, maybe we're not going to have the Empire of Guadalupe established here, but maybe we can get something closer to Viktor Orban's Hungary. So in that way, it's emerging as the sort of somewhat more realistic model for them, which is terrifying for anybody who would not fit well under Viktor Orban's autocratic, deeply, you know, anti-LGBTQ, anti-freedom of the press, anti-academic freedom, anti-so many things, extremely xenophobic, quite racist. But this is what they are moving towards as their model, at least. So that is why Tucker Carlson is going back there next week.
You touched on this briefly. I really appreciate the overview that you provided and the danger that it poses that this is seen as an exemplar. You touched on kind of what the theocratic vision is. It's theocracy, but they're doing it with the cultural aspects of Christianity or how they see Christianity and not readings of biblical scriptures or anything like that. How do you see this being expressed in this country with the goals and aims within the movement? What does them winning, what is their goal here? What are they trying to achieve? What does that look like to them?
Well, in reporting that piece, one thing that I really had to grapple with is that I don't know if there's one them. Conservatives in the US are very powerful right now, but amongst themselves, in November, they were expressing a lot of sense of sort of besiegement, even as, you know, while I was there, Glenn Youngkin won in Virginia, and they sort of had a wild party to celebrate that in the conference. But they were really there to try to build alliances between what are actually really some divergent factions. And so they're working, you know, part of organizing is to find ways that they can fit together, to find ways to make a coalition when they don't all agree with each other. So I think to some extent, what they are aiming for is a bit of a work in progress. But one of the things that one of the main organizers of the conference was put on by a group called the Edmund Burke Foundation. And so the chair of that organization, an Israeli academic named Yoram Hazoni, he led one of the nights of the conference, this panel discussion, which brought together four different basically thinkers on the right, either academics or writers or members of think tanks, things like that. And they were representing these different sides of the right. Yoram Hazony wrote a book called The Virtues of Nationalism. You know, another one of the speakers, a man named Sora Bamari, is a Catholic integralist who sometimes uses a different term for that, but he is basically a Catholic integralist. There was a guy there who's very much a libertarian, and then there was sort of an old school neocon. And so they were there with this really explicit purpose. Can we hash out one building block, one place to start in building this new sort of conservative fusionism to take the place of the other one that is no longer serving us, that's no longer really working? So they were trying to find kind of what is one piece of common ground that we can start on, even though two of those panelists were gay men. One of them is working in support, ideally, ultimately, of a totally Catholic-run society. The other one is an Orthodox Jew. I mean, so people were coming from different perspectives. But Yoram Hazony had proposed this idea. Why don't we start by saying in Christian areas, we should be able to reinstate Christian Bible lessons in those schools. And so this is an Orthodox Jew who is making this argument. So it sounds counterintuitive, but he has put a lot of thought into this. This is part of his idea of kind of what is a reasonable initial place to start in building this coalition. So they were talking about that, you know, kind of Hazony's broader agenda there. And I spoke to him for a while about this, is the idea of basically majority cultural rule. So in a place where there is a majority Christian population, he's saying Christians should be able to set the social norms, the social traditions should be respected, and multiculturalism is not going to have the same sort of sway there. Like he said, you know, we won't have active persecution of minorities, but they shouldn't expect this public square to be neutral, because they think that that is one of the places where liberalism has gone deeply astray. They think that liberalism, in seeking to really protect individual rights, minority rights, that it has trampled on the rights of the majority. And so part of this whole push is the idea that they are going to reassert majority rights. The sort of unspoken part of that, I think, has some context in Israel as well, saying the majority here should be able to have their culture be dominant, be adhered to, be the norm, and minorities, we won't maybe actively persecute them. This is the theory, but they have to understand that we're the majority. We get to have the culture. And so starting by offering this, by talking about Christian communities in the U.S., Christians should be able to set the majority culture because they are the majority in the U.S. The problem with that, I guess, like, how do you define that? In the past year, a new poll came out from Gallup that found for the first time since Gallup has been doing polling, it's less than half of the country actively belongs to and attends any sort of house of worship. So you can't really say as a nation, we are majority Christian. And so that's sort of where they start to get a little bit creative. And I talk about this a little bit more later on in the article, but they come up with this idea of cultural Christianity, that we're not going to define these things in terms of sincere belief or a level of devotion, but we're going to talk about it as sort of cultural Christianity, that it's good enough for, say, Donald Trump to go and have that photo op that he held in June 2020, where he stood in front of this church that had just been violently cleared of Black Lives Matter protesters and hold a Bible. And even though he's holding it upside down and he doesn't know anything that's in it, it's okay, because this is an example of cultural Christianity. He's sort of honoring the culture, this idea of America being a Christian country, even if there's nothing really sincere behind it. And they gave a number of similar examples like that. Matteo Salvini in Italy going up to a rally and like swinging a rosary around, or Marianne Maréchal Le Pen in France, the far-right nationalist leader there, talking about how Christianity is the bedrock of the country, even though she's divorced, Salvini is cohabitating, things that are fine, but things that are also widely condemned by Orthodox Christians. And so they're saying we need to make allowances for this because on the whole, their embrace of Christian symbols is positive for our cause. And can we say that's good enough so that we can sort of, you know, make a bigger tent, bring more of these people in so that we can move forward with this agenda, sort of national conservative agenda, this religious and majoritarian rule agenda.
Thank you for that, Catherine. It was really helpful. One thing that it seems pretty clear from our perspective is that what unites the various strains of American fascism is patriarchy, white supremacy, xenophobia, and the marriage between Christian fundamentalism and crass capitalism. And in writing about the National Conservatism Conference last November, you mentioned that a significant theme of the discussion amongst the fascists is the question of what unites the right. And you were talking about that just now. And I guess my question is, to the extent that they are fractured, fractured? What keeps them from the unity that they desire? And are these alliances shifting in any meaningful way?
Well, I'll give again the example of this sort of panel discussion at the conference that had that explicit goal of trying to find a starting point for coalition. And so as they were talking about that, you know, you could see some of those fault lines a little bit. I mean, they are there just kind of on the level of identity. If one of those people is ultimately hoping to establish a government that is run towards their understanding of the highest good as informed by their kind of reading of Catholic doctrine, that in and of itself is a fault line between them and anybody who's not on board, you know, with that religious interpretation of how life should be run. But there is this division between what Yoram Hazony was terming as the national conservatives and what he was calling anti-Marxist liberals, by which he means still extremely conservative people. He's talking about right-wing activists, but he's talking about right-wing activists who still subscribe to small L liberalism. This idea that individual rights really need to be protected. This needs to be a guiding principle of government. Some of them are libertarians. So he's saying the anti-Marxist liberal friends. He's not talking about folks writing at The Atlantic. He's talking about people running right-wing podcasts and writing those columns, but just coming from a different ideological perspective. So, I mean, I think like at that kind of big ideological level, that's one of those divisions. Again, it came up in that discussion that two of those panelists are gay men. And, you know, one of them was talking about me and my husband are hoping to become parents sometime soon. What you're talking about, where do we fit into this? And so there was some discussion of what that would mean. What does it mean to not actively persecute minorities? And I think sort of ironically, at least in my ears, Hungary came up as an example there. Hungary was offered as this example of a place where LGBTQ people are not being persecuted because homosexuality in and of itself is not illegal. Even though it's illegal to get married or to adopt or now to have any of your kind of written content or other media be accessible by anybody who's under 18. I imagine that's the age of majority in Hungary, but I'm actually not quite sure. But it's being offered. What to us, I think, sounds like an extremely oppressive situation is being described as one where people are not persecuted because it's not technically illegal to be in a same-sex relationship. You just can't have any of these other things. I mean, so I think that those are some of the sorts of things that people are trying to hash out on the right as they're trying to make their way towards these new coalitions.
Shifting our conversation back to what people are seeing in their everyday or what they're seeing on the news. A lot of people have seen the wild and ever violent school board meetings where reactionary parents object to mask mandates, to critical race theory, and people who are paying attention have probably noticed a shift from those specifics to parental rights discourse. This isn't just new packaging for the craziness of 2021, but something deeper. Can you talk about that and how it fires into the larger Christian fascist agenda and how it's become broader and broader? The range of what is this emphasis on parental rights and what that's really about. And to me, it's that movement returning to its roots, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people who pay attention to education have been noticing for a while how parental rights has been becoming this theme on the right. There's a wonderful journalist named Jennifer Berkshire who had a great column in The Nation back in the fall, which was one of the first places I saw somebody writing about that. So just to give credit there. But she was talking about Mike Pompeo seemingly doing some 2024 exploratory touring in New Hampshire last year. And in one of the events, he went and started talking up the idea of parental rights, that schools should be teaching children what parents want them to learn, which not that long ago, I think, would have been a bit of a more radical statement than it is right now, because now this is just becoming this kind of drumbeat message among Republicans. And a lot of that is thanks to what happened in Virginia in the race that Glenn Youngkin won, where he really made a lot of hay out of the fact that his opponent weighed in to these right-wing accusations around the idea of critical race theory by saying what parents want kids to learn is not the only thing that kids should learn. So yeah, I mean, I think critical race theory, as probably anyone who's been paying attention over the last year knows, is this debate that really emerged so rapidly over the course of a few months. A lot of that is thanks to a right-wing think tank called the Manhattan Institute that really did a lot to turn this into the right's new boogeyman, that critical race theory is lining up children and dividing them into groups of oppressors or oppressed, that they are making white children cry by telling them that they're oppressors. Just tons and tons of rhetoric rhetoric that came out and then was just repeated sort of nonstop on right-wing media to the point where this became a huge media issue and then unsurprisingly started sparking some of this grassroots or sometimes astroturf activism of parents going and confronting school boards. You know, I think the way that this story gets told on the right is that with the pandemic and with a lot of kids learning online, parents started seeing what their kids had been learning all along and they rose up kind of organically in anger. You know, I don't think it happened anything like that. I think this was, you know, a very concerted, very organized propaganda push to make parents fear something was happening that is not actually happening. And also just this sort of very elastic definition started being used to talk about what critical race theory is. So one of the pieces that I wrote for Salon last week was about a new series of videos that focus on the family. The Christian right kind of parachurch ministry group put out for parents. It's kind of got this like PSA, the more you know sort of feel to it. And it's this self-directed educational course for parents to learn more about critical race theory so they know what to do about it and how to talk to their kids about it. And in it, they've got three conservative leaders, one of whom was a speaker actually at the National Conservatism Conference that I went to, talking about their perspective on CRT and just kind of presenting it. So this is sort of the academic factual truth. And one of them is saying, you might not encounter CRT labeled as CRT. They might use words like diversity or inclusion instead. So it's that kind of a little bit of an illustration of how kind of anything that speaks to non-discrimination practices in schools can get relabeled as critical race theory, since critical race theory in and of itself is not being taught in those schools. There's just an awful lot going on there. Parents' rights, I mean, it has definitely used as part of the right-wing argument about that. It certainly was also used in terms of framing parents' oppositions to vaccine mandates for students returning to schools or mask mandates for kids when they're in schools. This has been framed as an issue of parents' medical rights. And one thing that's sort of interesting, I think, is how much some of the groups that are now expanding on that call, you know, as parents' rights is kind of moving beyond being a single issue thing. It's not just about CRT. It's not just about masks and vaccines, but it's this whole sort of organizing principle. We're starting to see the rise of these demands for parents' bill of rights, either kind of an amendment at the federal level or at numerous states around the country. These bills are being proposed to pass the parents' bill of rights. Some of them have passed. Florida, Ron DeSantis signed one back in June, and it went into effect in July, and it got used then as the basis of Ron DeSantis banning any school districts from having mask mandates for students who were returning. So there's sort of a lot of different things going on with that. But in some of the reporting that I did for a piece last week for Salon, you know, I talked about how one of the main groups that has been helping push these parents' Bill of Rights bills around the country is a group that has been basically pushing that same language for decades. They are a group that was founded originally by one of the most right-wing Christian homeschooling leaders out there, this guy, Michael Ferris, who also founded Patrick Henry College, the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, groups that have been very much kind of on the Christian right for a very long time. But now it's almost as though they have found their moment. They proposed a federal Parents' Bill of Rights a long time ago, and that sort of language is now being used. It's kind of finally caught on, found its moment.
Yeah, I completely agree that it's found its moment, and it's found this moment in carving out space to further projects, in my opinion, the most vicious white supremacy and also anti-science lunacy, in my opinion, under the guise of wanting to be involved in their child's education. Those are just my opinions, but that's a little bit of how I see it. And as we close out our conversation, which I've appreciated and really enjoyed, we really narrowly, I think, averted, and I think we can agree on this, what would have been a catastrophe if last year around this time, instead of Biden coming into power, Trump had remained. And so good that didn't happen. Nonetheless, here we are a year later, and we're seeing the evisceration of voting rights, of abortion rights on the chopping block, of the most revenge-fueled white rage How do you see the big picture of what I would call, you know, American fascism? I think you would probably call the conservative movement in the United States. How do you see this right now? What do you think people need to pay attention to that they may not be paying attention to? How are you seeing this?
Such a hard question. I frequently feel overwhelmed by it in a way that I think most people do. Looking at it frequently definitely doesn't make me feel less that way. I mean, I think that there are so many things we have to be paying attention to at once that both feels overwhelming to me and also makes me feel like the overwhelm is exactly kind of the feeling that's being driven for, because it's easy to feel powerless. I mean, I think that this parental rights has proven to be an effective organizing tool for them. I think they are going to flog that pretty hard in the coming year. And I think, you know, I'm far from the only person pointing that out or pointing out that that's going to drive a lot of local activism. The sort of stuff that's happening at the local levels is pretty surprising. I mean, one of the school board members in a Texas school district that got a lot of attention last year made some headlines last week, because this is kind of one of this new class of sort of reactionary parents' rights affiliated school board members made comments in a school board session that really seemed to be saying the fact that one district has more Black teachers is correlated with lower test scores. So just seeing that openly racist rhetoric being introduced, not just sort of in national politics or state politics, but at this super local level. School board meetings used to be more boring than they are now. I mean, like, they're not used to having like this sort of rhetoric be flying around. So, I mean, I think the stuff that's happening at a local level in those settings, and I'm sure at election board sort of positions as well, I think is something to pay attention to. I think that there is an awful lot of envelope pushing on the far right. White nationalist actors are getting involved local politics as well. I just had a piece come out this week that was drawing attention really to the reporting done by another researcher named Ben Lorber at Political Research Associates, who had this amazing investigation come out that found one of the gubernatorial candidates in Texas, Don Huffines, has an open white nationalist, a guy who was deeply involved in Nick Fuentes' America First / Greufer movement, on his staff. And all this reporting came out about it, and he's now firing the guy. He said that to fire the guy would be participating in cancel culture. So it just seems to be indicative of the way that this stuff is being normalized all the time. So I think we sort of have to be paying attention on a lot of different levels at once, because stuff is happening at different levels all at once. I think it's always important. It can seem a little esoteric to pay attention to the stuff that's happening in the intellectual corners of the movement. People who pay attention, I think, know better than to write off the right as being stupid or uneducated. Some of these people are highly, highly educated, very smart, and they are making what are coherent arguments within kind of their worldview for the direction they would like to take things in. And these are the people, it's a much more polite face of radical right activism than the people who are screaming racial slurs or kind of storming the Capitol for that matter. But these are the people who are staffing the think tanks and writing the magazines and publishing the books that fuel a lot of this movement a couple of stages up. So I think it's important to pay attention to them too.
I really agree. And I thank you so much for sharing your expertise and perspective with us. I also think that we are lucky that in a moment where we have to be paying attention to so much, that we have people digging deeper and investigating some aspects of this so that we can understand what we're up against. Because if we don't understand it, we can't stop. So I want to thank you again. And listeners can find more from Catherine by checking out the show notes. And you can read the latest from Catherine at salon.com and follow her on Twitter at Catherine A. Jules.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Refuse Fascism. I want to hear from you, share your thoughts, questions, ideas for topics or guests, or lend a skill. Tweet me at Sam B. Goldman, or you can drop me a line at SamanthaGoldman@refusefascism.org. Leave a voicemail by calling 917-426-7582. You can also record a voice message by going to anchor.fm/refuse-fascism and clicking the button there. Want to support the show? It's simple. Show us some love by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts or your listening platform of choice. And of course,
follow, subscribe, so you never miss an episode. Chip in to support our pod and content creation to help people understand and act to stop the fascist threat. You can donate by visiting refusefascism.org and hitting the donate button. Venmo, refuse-fascism, Cash App, Refuse Fascism. Thanks to Coco Das, Richie Marini, Lena Thorne, and Mark Tinkelman for helping produce this episode. Thanks to incredible volunteers, we have transcripts available for each episode. So be sure to visit refusefascism.org and sign up to get them in your inbox each week. We'll be back next Sunday. Until then, in the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America.